Izamit Carr, and I'm Telly Concepcion, and together we are Beyond the Numbers Podcast. We go beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. So come learn, grow, and have some fun with us. We are Beyond the Numbers Podcast.
In today's episode, the guys discuss The Last Dance episodes 3 and 4, Michael Jordan versus Phil Jackson versus Dennis Rodman, and go beyond the numbers of Michael Jordan's second three-peat with the Chicago Bulls. But first, their numbers of the day.
So my numbers for the day are 2,130, and that's to say, on April 30th, 1939, Lou Gehrig made his final MLB appearance with the Yankees, and it ended up actually being his final appearance in Major League Baseball, and this ended his 2,130th consecutive game streak. He asked manager Joe McCarthy at the time to take him out of the lineup, and it was the first and last time he played.
My number of the day is 7, as in 7 Gators in the 2020 NFL draft class. Congratulations to my Gators. In the first round, C.J. Henderson was taken 9th overall by the Jacksonville Jaguars. Van Jefferson, wide receiver, taken by the Rams. Deion Jabari Zuniga, the steal of the draft, was taken by the Jets. Linebacker Jonathan Greenard was taken by the Texans. LaMichael Perine, running back, taken by the Jets, so they doubled up on Gators there. Wide receiver Freddie Swain is going to the Seahawks, and wide receiver Tyree Cleveland is going to the Denver Broncos. Congratulations on achieving your dreams. Let's get it.
Can we get a little Jets chant there?
J-E-T-S, Jets, Jets.
Jets, Jets. Come on now, a little bit. Come on. You know we got some Jets fans out there. Jets. You got to put a little emphasis into it.
That's true. That's true. We got Jets fans out there. They got to change the name to the New York Gators, though.
It's getting there.
We'd like to dedicate this week's episode to Captain Tom. Captain Thomas Moore, a World War II veteran from the UK, wanted to help healthcare workers fighting the coronavirus. He started with a goal to raise $1,200 by walking 100 laps to celebrate his 100th birthday. To date, his fundraiser has topped $41 million. To a true hero, Captain Tom, we salute you. So for our first story, we cover Michael Jordan as the Chicago Bulls' second three-peat. Numbers 3, 2, and 1. 3, Jordan's second three-peat. 3 more scoring titles. 3 more finals MVPs, 2 more league MVP awards, and 1 incredible, memorable shot to end his career.
For those of you that don't know the story, Michael retired to pursue baseball. His retirement lasted 21 months, as we mentioned in our last podcast. We talked about his little baseball career. And then Michael on his way back to becoming, you know, a productive baseball player when the strike happened. So when the work stoppage happened for baseball, Michael decided to return back to basketball.
Yeah, and he returned in 1994-95 by sending his now famous fax quote, "I'm back." That's all it said. The season that gets lost a little bit that we wanted to start with is the season that Michael actually returned, because it feels like a lot of times, right, you talk about the first three-peat, baseball, a second three-peat. But Michael actually came back mid-season of the 94-95 season, and that's a season that I feel like gets lost. In 17 regular season games, Michael averaged 26.9 points, 6.9 rebounds, and 5.3 assists. He sparked the team to a 9-1 record in April. His first game, he was a little rusty, but in his second game against the New York Knicks, it's called the double nickel game, Michael Jordan knocked the rust off and dropped 55 points on March 29th, just to show that he could still conjure up some of the old magic.
But it's the Knicks, so does it really count?
It was the Knicks, but we're talking about 90s Knicks, mid-90s Knicks. I'm not talking about now Knicks.
That's true.
These were legit Knicks.
That's fair. I'll give you that.
So he powered the teams to the playoffs that year, and he was wearing number 45 because the Bulls had already retired number 23. They had already erected the statue in front of the new United Center. And Michael Jordan and the Bulls faced the Orlando Magic with Penny and Shaq and their old friend Horace Grant. They dropped game one, and after dropping game one, Nick Anderson says, number 45 doesn't explode like number 23 used to. Number 45 is not number 23. I couldn't have done that to number 23. Following that game, NBA fans never saw Michael Jordan wear number 45 again. He switched back to number 23 in game two, reversing the number's initial retirement, and scored 38 points in Chicago's win. They ultimately lost that series, right, Amit?
That's right. They ended up losing to Horace Grant and the Magic in six games, but we don't talk about that. That didn't happen. It's not considered a full season for him.
Yeah, that didn't happen. Penny and Shaq went on. They should have won. They end up losing in the finals that year. What could have been? That ultimately led Shaq going to the Lakers and altering NBA history. So now, Michael's first full season back, the 95-96 regular season. The reason they lost that finals is that the Magic overpowered them with Shaq in the middle. They lost their big man, Horace Grant. They needed to fill that hole. They made a phone call, Amit. And as the Last Dance documentary is covering, they pick up none other than...
Scottie Pippen. Nope. Dennis Rodman.
Dennis Rodman to fill the middle. And the team dominated the league that year, starting 41-3. And the Bulls eventually finished the 95-96 season with a regular season record, 72 wins, only 10 losses. Not bad for a guy who went on vacation for a while, came back just to set the league on fire.
Yeah, and you know, during that 44-game stretch where they went 41-3, Jordan averaged 38 minutes a game. He shot 49.8%. field goals and 38% from three-point land. He averaged 36-4, so that's 30 points, 6 rebounds, and 4 assists. And in the 10 games that the Bulls lost that entire season, Jordan averaged 40 minutes a game and shot 43% from the field goal.
And needless to say, Jordan led the league in scoring in his first full season back. I can't reiterate this enough. Leads the league in scoring with 30.4 points a game, won the league's regular season and the All-Star Game MVP awards, and led the Chicago Bulls to the playoffs.
So when we get into the playoffs, the Bulls only lost 3 games out of the 4 series they played. They won in Miami 3-0. New York took them 4-1. So they did lose one game to the Knicks.
A gentleman.
They swept the Magic in 4-0, and then they ended up beating the Seattle Supersonics 4-2 in the NBA Finals to win their 4th championship.
And that team was great with Sean Kemp, Def LaShrimp. They had Gary Payton. I mean, that was a stacked Seattle Supersonics team. And they faced Michael Jordan, who was on a mission that year. He ended up winning his 4th Finals MVP, which at that time was a record, passing Magic Johnson's 3 final MVPs. He also achieved only the 2nd sweep ever of MVP awards. He won the All-Star Game MVP, the regular season MVP, and the NBA Finals MVP. He was the first to do it since the 69-70 season. Any ideas who and what team did it, Amit, before?
It may have been Willis Reed, potentially.
It was Willis Reed of the New York Knickerbockers who did it last.
The Knicks were good in the 70s.
Yeah, the Knicks were good. That's a 30 for 30 on that. When the Garden was even. Also, who was on that team as well? None other than Mr. Phil Jackson.
That's right.
Played for the Knicks for 11 seasons. This finals was very memorable because it was Michael's first since he retired And as you guys remember from the last podcast, Michael retired in part because he wanted his dad to have seen his final game. His dad was tragically murdered just days after he won his third championship with the Bulls over the Suns in 1993. And so he wins this championship on Father's Day. And Jordan's emotion saw him crying on the floor of the locker room with the game ball. I think that's one of the most memorable pictures or images of Michael Jordan throughout his career. Moving on to the 96-97 season, the Bulls start out with a record of 69-11, but they missed out on having a second consecutive 70-win season by losing their last two games to finish 69-13. During the 1997 NBA All-Star Game, Jordan posted the first triple-double ever in All-Star Game history and ended up winning the game for the East. However, he did not receive the MVP award. I was floored by this. How do you make history in the All-Star Game and your name is Michael Jordan and you have a triple-double and not win the All-Star Game MVP?
Well, the only way that happens is if someone else also makes history in that game. And the winner of the MVP award that season in that game was Glenn Rice of the Charlotte Hornets. He played 25 minutes, he scored 26 points, and he broke two records in the process. The first record was 20 points in the third quarter, and the second was 24 points in the second half. So Rice's 20 points in the period broke Hal Greer's record of 19, which was set in 1968, and his 24 points in the half surpassed the previous mark of 23, owned by Wilt Chamberlain and Tom Chambers.
Okay, so Glenn Rice makes a little bit of history, spoils the party for MJ, who only went on to score 14 points, 11 rebounds, and 11 assists. That was all a first. And we want to go beyond the numbers here until the 2011 NBA All-Star Game. That was the only triple-double in NBA history. LeBron did it in 2011. D-Wade did it in 2012. And Kevin Durant now did it in 2017. That wasn't the only time Jordan was snubbed for an MVP award that season. He was also beaten by Karl Malone of the Utah Jazz for the NBA MVP for that season on it. But not to be outdone, Michael had something up his sleeve. The Bulls again advanced to the NBA Finals, where they face none other than Karl Malone and the Utah Jazz for that final series. And, spoiler alert, like he had done previously, ends up getting the MVP award of the finals like he did to Charles Barkley in 93 when Barkley stole the finals and the regular season MVP award from him. The series against the Jazz featured two of the most memorable clutch moments of Jordan's career. And I would argue that his career, the later half of his career, post-retirement part of his career, was defined by these moments. He won game one for the Bulls with the buzzer-beating jump shot. And that probably would have been the moment that we'd remember for these finals and for the second half of his career. But he followed that up in game five on it. The series is tied at two games, two apiece, and the Jazz actually, I believe, had one of the best records in the league that year. And despite being feverish and dehydrated from a stomach virus, quote unquote, this gives us the flu game. Jordan can't even stand up. Scotty's got to pick him up and take him to the bench. He's got to put a towel on his head. He looks like, you know, he can't even stand at this moment. He only goes on to score 38 points, including the game-deciding three-pointer with 25 seconds left in the game. The Bulls win that game 90-88 and go on to win the series in six games. For the fifth time in as many final appearances, Michael Jordan receives the Finals MVP award and kind of, you know, sticks his tongue out at Karl Malone like, all right, they gave you the MVP. That's good, but I'm going to take this championship and I'm going to take this Finals MVP. How you like me now?
I mean, in retrospect, when you think of what's going on in the world right now, playing a game while having the flu, quote unquote, seems slightly reckless, right?
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I mean, but I mean, you know what I'm saying. It in the moment, though, it's just an incredible feat to see him go up and go above and beyond. You know, you kind of have those supernatural abilities pop into play, and he just kind of went off, even though he didn't necessarily have the physical strength. He had the mental toughness to make it through. So some cool little tidbits, you know, over the course of two seasons from November of 95 through June of 97, the Bulls were favored in 185 consecutive games. It's the longest such streak that ESPN had in their databases, dating back only back to 1990. And the second one isn't even close. The Golden State Warriors own the second longest streak, and they were favored in 89 consecutive games from March 31st, 2017 to March 6th, 2018. So the Bulls streak was almost twice as long as that. So for those of you out there that remember, you know, those dominant Warriors, that dominant Warriors team, just think about how much longer the Bulls were just, you know, just lights out, unbeatable. And then the other piece is the Bulls streak began in 95, and Jordan's first full season back from missing essentially two seasons while playing baseball. So on November 26, 95, Chicago was a 2.5 road underdog to the Seattle Supersonics squad that had Gary Payton and Sean Kemp. The Sonics won 97-92. And that was, of course, the preview for the 96 finals. The next night, the Bulls are favored on the road in Portland that started that streak that lasted all the way through to game three of the 97 finals against the Jazz. So that is an incredible streak of time to be favored against everyone you're playing.
That's crazy. That brings us to 97-98 season. The Last Dance, as Phil Jackson coined it. And that's what The Last Dance, the documentary, is about. And we won't digress here, but during the regular season, Jordan and the Bulls compiled a 62-20 record. Jordan led the league once again with 28.7 points a game, securing his fifth regular season MVP award, plus honors for All-NBA First Team, First Defensive Team, and the All-Star Game MVP.
When you look at the playoffs, the Bulls won the Eastern Conference Championship for a third straight season, including surviving a seven-game series against the Pacers in the Eastern Conference Final. It was the first time Jordan had played in a Game 7 since the 92 Eastern Conference semifinals with the Knicks. Overall, Jordan is 2-1 in Game 7s, and the only time he lost, for those of you watching The Last Dance, documentary, you saw this recently, his only Game 7 loss was in the Pippen migraine game against the Pistons. So after winning that game, after winning that seven game series with Indiana, they were able to move on for a rematch with the Jazz.
So the Bulls returned to the Delta Center for Game 6 of the finals on June 14, 1998, leading the series 3-2. Jordan executes what's considered one of the greatest clutch performances in NBA history. The Bulls are trailing 86-83 with 41.9 seconds remaining in the fourth quarter. Phil Jackson calls a timeout. When plays resume, Jordan receives the inbound pass, drove to the basket, and hit a shot over a couple of Jazz defenders, cutting the lead to 86-85 for the Jazz. The Jazz bring the ball up the court and pass the ball to forward Karl Malone, who was set up in the low post and was being guarded by Rodman. And I can still see this and remember it like it was yesterday. Malone jostled with Rodman and caught the pass, but Jordan cuts in from behind, takes the ball right out of his hands for a steal. Jordan dribbles it down the court, paused, eyes his defender, who at the time was Byron Russell, with 10 seconds left in the game, possibly pushing off Russell. We won't talk about that, though. With 5.2 seconds left, Jordan goes right, crosses over to his left, and makes that final shot that we all do at the park, at the gym, leaves the hand up in the air to win his sixth NBA Finals. But what we forget is after that, the Jazz still had a possession. They pass it to John Stockton, who barely misses a game-winning three-pointer. The buzzer sounds. Jordan and the Bulls win their sixth NBA championship, achieving their second three-peat in the decade. Once again, goes without saying, Jordan was voted Finals MVP. He led all scorers on it with 33.5 points a game, including 45 points in that game six. Jordan's sixth Finals MVP is a record. In second place is Shaq, Magic, LeBron, and Tim Duncan, all with three apiece, so it's not even close. And the 1998 Finals holds the highest television rating of any final series in history. Game six holds the highest television rating of any game in NBA history.
It's crazy. That is absolutely insane. Let's jump into episode three, Tully.
Yeah, episode three was fascinating. It's the introduction of Dennis Rodman. So episode three starts straight up with Dennis, and Dennis saying, I want to feel the hurt. I want to get my nose broke.
Yeah, it's something Dennis always wanted. He wanted to feel that pain.
And yeah, I would love to see Dennis as a football player. Like, you know, he wants to feel hurt and pain. Like, try some football for sure.
You know, as I was watching and listening to this, I was thinking about, man, if MMA was around back then, like, just based on his personality and his loudness, like, he would be perfect for MMA.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. He'd definitely be perfect for MMA. And just to give the Beyonders some back information here. So in preparation for The Last Dance, Ahmed and I actually made it a point to watch the 30 for 30 on Dennis Rodman called Rodman.
For better or worse.
For better or worse, that's right. For better or worse. And so they had a lot more backstory on Dennis Rodman than they do necessarily here in The Last Dance. But as the episode starts, he wants to feel hurt. He wants to feel pain. And it also showed that the refs weren't calling things for Dennis. He had a horrible game. And I think this really epitomizes Dennis Rodman, especially if you go back and watch For Better or Worse, which is specifically about him. But he definitely wants to please people and he wants people to like him. And overall, he's a shy person despite his outgoing persona and the persona that he has with dyeing his hair and doing all the things he does during the game. So he had a horrible game. He didn't apologize, but he goes to Michael Jordan's room. And the way they cut it in The Last Dance was great because they cut to Michael. They cut to Scotty. He had a bad game. He went to Michael's room and asked for a cigar. And from then on, Dennis was focused. And, you know, Michael said he didn't apologize. He never used the word sorry. But essentially, since he never, ever went to Michael's room, that meant, I'm not going to let you down. I'm not going to let my team down. And I'm not going to let the city down.
Yeah, I mean, he admits he screwed up. And I think one of the things Dennis was proud of was, you know, you could say a lot of things about me, but I was never a bad teammate. And when you look at Rodman's sort of contributions to that team, I don't know if the Bulls could have won without Rodman, to his point. I mean, he says it, but he averaged 15.3 rebounds a game during his 3 years with the Bulls. That's crazy.
Yeah, that's a steal.
Yeah, and with Scotty out for those first, was it 30-plus games? I don't know if they would have been able to hold it together to give them a chance for the finals if he wasn't there to hold it down. And I think Phil said it the best. You know, Dennis is what held us together when Scotty was out. So, you know, it was cool to see this guy that, when it comes to like his own life and his personal life, really seems out of control. But once he sort of had that dang, I messed up, sorry, Michael moment, he kind of locked it down and kind of put himself in a whole nother mode to get them there.
Yeah, and he felt needed by Michael for sure, right? Scotty's out, so he's the number two. And he needs that, I'm needed here, I'm wanted here, I'm being accepted here. So I think that's very important for his psyche and the way that he plays. The Last Dance now flashback and shows part of Rodman's early life. His mom drove school buses and kicked him out at the age of 18.
Yeah, and it's crazy to think, how does he stay out of trouble? Because he doesn't even know. Like, when you think of the Rodman that we know in the late 90s and even up till today, the fact that he wasn't into drugs and alcohol and was just kind of living in backyards, seeing this stuff go on all around him but never partaking in it, is just crazy to me.
Yeah, and he says that exactly. He says, I never did drugs, although it was all around me. He'd hang out with guys who were selling. He'd hang out with guys who were doing it. And he said, I never messed with any of that stuff. He lived on the streets for 2 years. And aside from that, Ahmet somehow grows 11 inches. This is after high school, after he turns 18. And while he's living on the streets for 2 years, he grows 11 inches.
Yeah, this is kind of an ongoing theme. When you look at Jordan, when you look at Pippen, when you look at Rodman, they all had these crazy growth spurts. Rodman's, I think, was probably later than the rest of them.
Yeah, later and more pronounced. 11, he grew a foot, man, he grew a foot. That's ridiculous.
But, you know, you see that with all of them, and I think they refer to it as they kind of exploded. And that's, it's crazy, but I can't say this enough. If those of you listening, if you haven't seen the 30 for 30 on Rodman, it goes in depth. You get a real sense of who he is. It's interesting and it's sad all at the same time, but it's definitely a good watch. And I'm glad that they didn't go, you know, of course, for The Last Dance, he's limited to how many episodes and how long he can do it. So he didn't want to, I guess, rehash some of the stuff that was already out there. So I definitely felt as though this episode skimmed over a lot of who and what Rodman is and was to the Bulls. But definitely, if you get a chance, that 30 for 30 is a must see.
Yeah, and his escape, and one of the pieces they didn't include in The Last Dance, but we want to break it down for you here, is his escape from being on the streets, his escape from being around people doing drugs, was going to the gym. He just liked playing basketball. He didn't make the team in high school. He was too small and not athletic enough, so he didn't make the team, and he would play at the gym, where he caught the eye of Southeast Oklahoma State coach, who actually went to his house to recruit him and basically waited outside of his room for like 2 or 3 hours because Dennis was too shy and scared to come out and talk to the coach. The coach bid his time and ends up getting one of the best, probably the best player in that school's history, where Dennis goes on to average 27 points, 15 rebounds a game in college at Southeast Oklahoma State, and becomes the 27th overall pick in the NBA draft.
And I think that inspires one of his teammates with the Bulls, isn't it?
Yeah, that's where Scotty said, you know, Scotty went to Central Arkansas, also had a late spurt, also didn't make the team or have a scholarship when he started in college, begged for one, showed his game, grew, and, you know, ends up getting drafted from a small school as well. So he definitely gave Scotty hope that a guy from a small school could make it on the big stage. So go ahead.
No, so I was going to say, like, so this is where I thought it was really cool to see sort of what they do in the documentary with Dennis and talking about how he trained. So you talked about how he was going to the gym, how he was working out and practicing with friends just to kind of improve his rebounding skills. And it was so, so cool to see him talk about how he would practice how the ball comes off the backboard and off the rim, you know, based on different players. So if Larry Bird shoots the way he shoots, it's going to come off the backboard or come off the rim and go in a certain direction. If someone else shoots it, if Jordan shoots it, it's going to come off a different direction. And he really understood ball angles, trajectory, so that he could be in the right position to rebound. Like, he was truly a student of the game. And I think a lot of times we miss that when we think of all the antics outside of him, all that you see in the media and all of that. And you think, oh, he just kind of shows up and plays because he's lucky to have the ability. No, he definitely put a lot of time and effort into learning. I think you see it from time to time in the documentary where, you know, you see him with the headphones on, either looking over probably stats sheets, probably notes, watching film, all that kind of stuff. So he was definitely a student of the game.
Yeah, and success doesn't come by accident. I think he really was, like you said, a student of the game. It took him 2 or 3 years to figure out, like he says in the documentary, what he was good at. And once he figured out that was defense and rebound, all his focus went to defense and rebounding. And he would just go. He would have friends shoot at 3, 4 in the morning, go to the gym and shoot so he can just react to the angle of the ball and react to the ball. And really, he was a shy, quiet kid when he started in Detroit. And in his 30 for 30, a lot of the teammates he had in Detroit talk about how Dennis was a shy, quiet kid. He liked going to the arcade. He drank a glass of milk when they went out. But his troublemaking began in Detroit, mostly from their style of play, because as it says in the documentary, they were threatening the safety of the league's top players.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't really care. They were just out there to make a point. And the league was very different at that time. So you could essentially just manhandle people, beat them up, elbow them, and not even get teed up, let alone kicked out of games, right? So it was definitely a much more physical, aggressive brand of basketball. And they were very open about what they were going to be doing. You knew their game plan when you were playing the Bad Boy Pistons.
And this was the start of the Bad Boy Pistons. They gave themselves that moniker, as they explain in their 30 for 30, the Bad Boys, because they felt like they were spoiling the NBA's party, where the torch was being passed from Larry Bird to Magic Johnson. Natural in the line of succession was Michael Jordan, marketable, good-looking guy, very personable. And they came to crash the party, and they made that very clear. But what they also made clear, and they talked about this in For Better or Worse, the Rodman story, is that Dennis really fed into this Bad Boys, us against the world, not just on the court, but basically in life. And a lot of those guys look like they had a level of remorse because they feel like Dennis almost took that identity too hard, right?
Yeah, and it was, you know, they talk about how it was, that was his family. Like that Pistons team was his family. And so you really see, you know, he went from that quiet kid to really taking off with that persona and personality. And then when his quote unquote family kind of broke up, you know, after that 90, you know, after they won those two championships together, you could kind of see where he veered off because he once again lost a family and felt like he was kind of out and alone.
Yeah. And episode 3 also gives us another gem, Doug Collins, which I didn't know much about other than that's the voice I hear for most NBA games I watch. So I'm thinking he's cool, calm, and collected. Turns out back in the day, my man was anything but, right, Amit?
Yeah, he was a wild child. He had the same energy and sort of perspective of the game as Jordan did, right? Like just high intensity, win, win, win was his thought process in his head.
So yeah, we get to check out Doug Collins, the Doug Collins Chicago Bulls, the Chicago Sports Casino, as MJ says, Chicago Sports Casino, while they're on the private jet. And then Doug Collins' first ever game against the New York Knicks, Amit. And, you know, Doug Collins said he has white around his lips. He's sweating. He's scared he's going to lose this game. And Michael looks at him and says, Coach, I'm not going to let you lose your first game. Michael goes on to score the last 10 points of the game, ends up with a then record at Madison Square Garden in New York City of 50 points at that time. Of course, against the Knicks. And then Jordan goes back, as we discussed earlier in the podcast, to score 55 against the Knicks in the second game back from his return.
And that 50 points, I think, was a record for a visiting player. But Kobe does, you know, of course, many, many years later in 2009, Kobe dropped 61 against my Knicks at the Garden. And that is the most at MSG by any player, which broke the near and dear Bernard King, who scored 60 points at the Garden on Christmas Day in 1984. But, you know, in Knicks fashion, when Bernard King dropped those 60 points at the Garden, they lost that game. So, you know, Jordan's 55 in a win, or Jordan's 50 in a win, and I think Jordan's 55 in the win that we talked about. But at least they won those games when he dropped those points. But the Knicks, even when they scored home in big numbers, can't win. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think the Doug Collins portion of the episode was probably the funnest portion of the episode. I mean, I'm sitting here laughing, smiling. Doug Collins said, quote, "The greatest respect you could give a great player is to coach him and coach him hard." So he used to switch Michael from the starting five in practice, let them go up 10 points or however many points, switch Mike to the other team and tell him to try and go and win this now. And he kept trying to keep practice competitive, which led to probably one of my favorite parts of the documentary so far, in that, you know, the media is thinking there's beef because Michael was mad because practice was stacked against him. And Doug Collins says, "Mike, come here. You might give me a kiss here on TV so we can show these guys, you know, everything's cool. We're all good. See, we kissed, we made up, it's all good." And they share a kiss on television, Michael Jordan and Doug Collins. And it really seemed like Michael had an affinity for Doug Collins throughout the episode, whenever they asked him questions about Doug Collins. Because like you said, this is the guy who is most like me. He wants to win. He wants to win at all costs. And that segment ends with Doug Collins saying, "When I coached Michael Jordan, he won MVP, Defensive Player of the Year, All-Star MVP from 86 to 89. And, quote, that's greatness." Then we get the Cleveland Cavaliers versus the Bulls. "You played a team six times in division. They beat us six times," said MJ. "We had nothing to lose." So Lacey, Kent, and Sam, we took care of you. We took care of you, and we'll take care of you today. And this is the famous shot. With 0.6 seconds left, Jordan puts the Bulls up one. Elo puts the Cavs up one. And they call a timeout, and they put Elo on Mike instead of Ron Harper. Ron Harper still seems salty during the documentary at this part on it. He still seems salty.
He does. He looked really mad because I think even Jordan felt that you know, Ron was the best guy to guard him. So yeah. I think even Jordan was a little surprised that he didn't have Ron on him for that final play.
And this gave us the shot where Jordan makes the shot, starts fist bumping, and basically cements his place in history as he made it. He won a series in the playoffs. Next came the Bad Boy Pistons. And it was important for the NBA that Michael make it to the next level. And Mike goes off for game three. The Bulls are up 2-1. And then Amit,
they hit him with the Jordan rules, right? So the thought process was, you know, you can't stop Mike once he takes flight. So when he's on the ground, that's when you can grab him. That's when you can get him into situations that make it difficult for him to score.
On the wings, push him to the elbow. On the top, force him left. In the low post, trap from the top. And if those don't work, knock him to the ground. They cut to interviewing Dennis Rodman here. And Dennis said, "We tried to physically hurt Michael Jordan." And Dennis actually said he earned a tremendous amount of respect for Michael Jordan for surviving these games, for surviving the Jordan rules.
He kept getting up. And, you know, the Bulls had to build themselves to beat the Pistons. And the more you think about it, the more you see how this kind of framed that entire franchise. Their toughness of getting past the Pistons, not just the "we need to get bigger and stronger to put up with these guys," but the mental toughness they needed to get past that team, I think really set them up to be able to win all the championships that they had. Because it's hard to go back-to-back, especially the way they did.
It definitely is. So, like you see in the documentary, you get to see Dennis working out, which you don't see often. You get to see him lifting weights. You get to see him running and preparing for games, which I think a lot of people just didn't associate with him. One of the funniest parts in the doc, towards the end, Craig Sager hands Dennis Rodman a $20 bill in the hallway to pay for his fine. I thought that was hilarious. Also, I mean, I love me some Stranger Things, but I don't know how Will Byers went back in time and had Dennis Rodman sign a paper for him and get his jersey and some shoes.
He got some shoes too.
So shouts out to Will Byers from Stranger Things, making a guest appearance in The Last Dance on ESPN. I see what Netflix did there. I see what Netflix did. I can't wait for the next episode. It's coming up in just a few
seconds.
For our last segment, we'll go into Beyond the Numbers of episode 4 of the Last Dance documentary, which picks up with Rodman escaping the United Center in his Harley Davidson and hightailing it to Vegas. And it starts right away with footage from Vegas, to which I was like, what? Who is filming? Remember, there are no cell phone cameras, okay, in 1997, 98. And they have cameras at the tables. They have cameras of Rodman dancing around. So was this the NBA crew, like, up in the building with, like, book-sized cameras getting all this footage?
Yeah, all these guys had camcorders. But let's not forget, they had Big Pun and Fat Joe. I don't want to be a player playing through this. And it was fantastic.
They also had that.
But no, these guys are clearly, his crew's got camcorders because they know it's going to be epic.
So yeah, I would agree. As soon as you have a meeting with Phil Jackson and Michael Jordan and say, hey guys, I'm sorry, but I need a vacation. Like, can you go to your boss and just be like, you know what? We're doing great things here. We really are. But, you know, I just need to escape for a little bit mid-season and clear my head. I'd like to do that in Vegas.
Yeah.
So Michael was right. And as he said in the last episode, we're not going to get Rodman back in 48 hours. So he goes over time and Michael had to go to his apartment and get him. And what's a misconception from the episode, but from hearing a lot of the after show episodes, primarily from Jalen Jacoby, who interviewed the director, Dennis had an apartment right across the street from the United Center. And that's where Michael got him. He didn't fly to Vegas to get him, but he got him from right across the street. Michael was also upset because they had a run, get Dennis back in shape drills, as Michael called it, but really the Indian drill, where the whole team is running laps. Whoever is in the front has to run to the back and catch the pack, vice versa. Michael forced everyone to slow the pace down. Here comes Dennis, who goes and runs full speed, and it takes the whole team 4 laps to catch Dennis, as if to say, I'm here, I never left, I'm good. And like Michael Jordan said, quote, he took a vacation, but he was always there. And it's just crazy to think that really Rodman was always there.
Yeah, and it's a testament to like his physical ability. Cause it's a lot of these greats, they go hard and you're like, how are you gonna, you're not gonna make it past 35, you're not gonna make it past 40. How do you survive doing this, right? Cause some guys are just taking pristine care of themselves, right? To just be at that level. And here's Rodman, he goes on a 3-day, 2-day bender in Vegas, comes back and he's like, he's never gone. He never left. He still has the same everything.
Nature versus nurture, my friend, nature versus nurture.
But this is where we learn that Phil is really Dennis. Like, they're the same guys, just like with a little different demeanor and temperament. But they're both, like, it's like they're cut from the same cloth, but just oddly very different sides of it.
Yeah, so they flash back now and show Phil Jackson, which I didn't know much about, right? Besides the coach, the teacher, the Zen master, I didn't know too much about Phil Jackson. He goes pro. And he spends 11 years with the Knicks on it. And he goes to 3 NBA finals and wins 2. The
two.
Knicks.
2.
When the Garden was Eden.
1970 and 1973, when the Knicks knew what they were doing and dominated the NBA. Well, not dominated, but at least they won. They won.
They won a couple of times. But yeah, that's the 70s.
50 years, Telly.
I'm still waiting for that. The glory days to return and for the Garden to become that place again. After his playing career, Phil Jackson goes to Puerto Rico and actually coaches in the Superior League, which plays every other day. After coaching in Puerto Rico, he coaches the Albany Patrons, and then the Bulls track him down. And dressed like a hippie, he shows up for some interviews.
Wait, Patrons or Patrons? It better be Patrons.
I think it's Patrons. I'm going to go with Patrons.
You know what? I'll let you have that. But here's one of those moments where, you know, Jerry Krause got hit pretty hard in those first 2 episodes. But here is a really, really ballsy move that, think about Phil's career from here onwards. Think about what the Bulls did. That was a very, very calculated move on Jerry's part, but also a huge risk, right? Because Doug Collins, like you said, that was Jordan's guy, and all of a sudden, you know, you've got this guy coming in, making this big move. And to your point, the triangle offense, nothing like what Jordan was used to, right? Because this is all about moving the ball around, making sure everyone, you know, the goal of the triangle offense was to make everyone on the team better, not just Jordan dominating and taking, you know, 30 points a game, 35 points a game.
And that was how Detroit was stopping them. Detroit was basically shutting down Jordan. They put in the Jordan rules. If Jordan can't score, they can't win. So if you stop the ball, if you stop Jordan, that's it. What surprised me the most in this part of the documentary was that Michael was kind of cool, at least it sounds like in the modern day interviews with Mike, with the team letting go of Doug Collins. Fast forward to 97-98, what The Last Dance is about, he essentially said he wouldn't play for another coach besides Phil Jackson. As close as they were, as thick as thieves as they seemed in during the 80s period, even kissing on national TV, I was just shocked that he let Doug Collins go so easily in that part. So they bring Phil in with a triangle offense, which essentially found a way to make everyone else better. Scotty flourished and created what's known as the point forward. Some similar players that play the point forward position now would be guys by the name of LeBron James and Kevin Durant. So Scotty essentially developed that playing in the triangle.
And it's to your point, I think this change, and we talked about this earlier, this change of going into the triangle offense, I think helped that Bulls team gain some longevity, right? Because I think if it was ISO Jordan, right, I think he'd be beaten down after a while, and he'd have, you know, there's a potential that he has Carmelo Anthony's career, right?
I don't know about that.
But you know what I mean. Like, he's
I
not
see
winning,
your point.
You're not
James Harden type career.
Well, yeah, James Harden career, Russell Westbrook career, right? You can put up triple doubles all night, every night, and you're still not going to win that championship.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think this to Phil's genius, and in this case, Jerry Krause's vision. You got a guy that came in and elevated the entire team. And I love that Phil was like, Mike, I'm not worried about you. I know you're going to be great. It's everyone else around you that also has to be great. And I think and when you see it and you see it play out, you know Mike was not okay with this for a while.
Oh,
yeah. Of course, initially he didn't like it, but I think it took him a while to kind of get into, wait. And I think he even said, like, I'm not going to dish it out to some random guy to make the shot. I'm going to take the shot.
I believe he said with 10 seconds left, I would not want Bill Cartwright to take the shot. That's not an equal opportunity offense.
That's right.
Which led to a great quote during that episode. The other note here, I think, is Michael said they're the better team. We want to be where they are. They were the better team today and shook hands. I'll put a pin on that there, Amit, and I'll come back to it in a little bit.
And you can pin that, but if you're out there and you haven't seen ESPN's 30 for 30 Bad Boys on the Bad Boy Pistons, check it out, because, and I know you listen to Jalen and Jacoby, they talk a lot about the blatant disrespect that the Bulls had. So disrespectful, as Stephen A. Smith would say, to the entire Pistons organization in Detroit for a lot of that season before they came back, before that return, and they finally lose to the Bulls and get swept by the Bulls. So there was a lot there before that comes up that kind of led to some of those dynamics.
So they lose game 7 and immediately start weight training starting in the offseason. No vacation, the whole team's together. Michael goes from 200 to 215 pounds and says, quote, I want to inflict pain, not take it. And it ate at him that he was only known as a star, not a winner like Magic and Larry were. It really ate at him. He said it in the modern day, and it showed a flashback of him saying it, and I believe him to the fullest. He said he used his energy to make his teammates better. So he built up Scottie Pippen. And Scottie says, quote, he built my confidence in what I needed. He gave him the drive and the mental focus of the game. And it cuts to Michael, and Michael says, you know, Scotty just needed somebody by his side that said, you know, I'll fight with you. Just fight. If you're standing next to him, he'll fight. So he was letting him know, you know, those Pistons times when Dennis Rodman was getting all in Scotty's face, if you stand right next to him, you make him stronger. So Michael really felt strongly about building Scotty and the rest of the team up. Fast forward to Scotty not reacting to Dennis pushing him, and it was over on it. I mean, Detroit knew it was over. Dennis pushes Scotty into the first row of the seats after he goes up for a layup. And Scotty just sits there on the ground, kind of like, okay, I got you. I got you. I see what you did.
And that was the final victory, right? That was the mental victory. Because for so long, the Pistons would push you around and you just feel helpless and you get angry, you respond. And like they say in the Bad Boys documentary, you know, when the Pistons heard you talking about wanting to fight them, they knew they were going to win because they were no longer thinking about the game of basketball. They were thinking about the physical game outside of basketball. And so I think in that moment, Scotty's like, yeah, you could push me around and hit me and try to hurt me. That's not going to impact my game, and that's not going to impact me draining buckets on you and winning this thing.
And this leads to the walkout by the Bad Boy Detroit Pistons. With 7.9 seconds left in the game, they start walking off the court. They disrespect Michael Jordan. And I told you earlier, put a pin in it, because Michael shook hands, said he appreciated the team, the challenge. They were the better team. He wanted to be where they were. Michael turns around and slays the dragon, and they walk off the court on it.
They walk off the court. I'll give you that. And I think this is where you and I may disagree on this. But I think Isaiah brought this up as well. You know, Boston did that to them, right? When Boston was handing the torch to the Pistons before they went on their little run, they left as well. It just so happened to be that at the Boston Garden, you could leave from the other side and not have to cross the bench of your opponents, right? Unfortunately, with the Pistons, in their arena, you had to walk past them to get out. So that was, in my mind, that was the big difference.
I mean, what made it worse?
The optics.
What made it worse? Isaiah ducked his head and put his hand up and walked right past Jordan. Like you said, we couldn't. The ducking of the head and the putting the hand up just made it seem grimy. But
Larry Bird walked. He was gone. Bird. They were still shooting free throws when Bird walked. Was gone. He was into the crowd and long gone.
This gives us one of the best reactions, though, of the whole documentary. It's when they hand Michael, he's like, I don't care what you hand me. I don't care what he has to say. It doesn't change the fact that he was extremely disrespectful in that time, and I'm cleaning that up a little bit. But basically, they show Isaiah Thomas, and Isaiah still had a smirk talking about it and said, well, knowing what I know now, if I had to do it again, I would change it. I just don't think Mike appreciated that, because he got his butt kicked for 3 years in a row by that team. And he felt like, man, I shook their hands the year before. He said, all you have to do is go back and see the year before. They beat us. They beat us in 7 games. I shook every one of their hands and told them good luck in the next round.
But to that point, like, right, it was the passing of the torch where, you know, from Isaiah's standpoint, we are the champions and we're handing it off to you versus you haven't done anything. You haven't beat us. So why, you know, what does that matter? If the Bulls had won some championships and then gotten beaten, I could understand, hey, you won a championship or two, now you lost, you got to hand it over to me. And to that point, Michael never had to go through that. He never had to lose when trying to defend a championship, right? He won 3, he retired, then he came back and won 3 more. He never had to go through that year of, I've won, oh, I lost this year. Right? Well,
Don't lose. If you don't want to not shake hands, don't lose. So this sets up the finals with the Lakers. So that wasn't even the finals, but the Bulls said that was their finals. In their mind, that was their hurdle. That's what they worked out all offseason to get past. And they dropped Game 1. But like we talked about in Beyond the Numbers, Episode 4, they lose Game 1, but they wouldn't look back after that. And it led to Game 2, where Michael Jordan gives us the switch. He's going up for the layup. He switches hands midair. And it also shows Phil Jackson coaching up Mike, asking who's open. And he drives and dishes to John Paxson, who actually closes out that game. Mike loses all his emotions, starts crying in the locker room, and they interview a lot of teammates who say, we didn't even know Mike had any emotions. We didn't know that he cared this much. We've only seen him yell and scream and get angry. And it also shed some light on Michael and Magic sharing a moment. Back to the earlier point about Isaiah, Mike and Magic didn't have to share that moment. Magic didn't have to hug Mike in the locker room. Magic had won championships. Magic knew what it was like to win championships, and essentially he was passing the torch. So it got snubbed. They didn't have to do it on the court. They didn't have to shake hands, but in the back of the locker room, Michael Jordan hugs Magic, and Magic tells him, dude, you're the next big thing. Jordan wins his first championship, and we can't wait for the next episode of The Last Dance. I am so excited. Catch our reactions next week.
Wait, we're not going to talk about Jerry Krause's statement?
Which one?
About Michael, about Phil not coming back?
Not till next week.
Okay.
Stay tuned. Thank you for going beyond the numbers with us. We're a weekly podcast dedicated to going beyond the numbers of sports and life to bring you the story within the story of the stories that matter. We're available on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Whatever you're listening on now, please be sure to click the follow or subscribe button to get our latest content.
And remember, you can find us on Instagram, Beyond the Numbers Podcast, and on Twitter, at Beyond TN Podcast.
Till next time, peace.